You hear their stories, right? Their journeys, where they're coming from. And they, I mean, these folks have aspirations as well. They have goals, they have dreams. And sometimes they feel like they're shut out of not just the economy, but also of the community.
Hello, Newark and everybody listening in. Welcome to episode 4 of season 3, Raz in 60 with Desiree Hadley and I.
Yes, excited. It's episode 3. We're almost done with the year. Last episode of 2022.
That's right. This is today we're going to be talking about our strategic plan to end chronic homelessness in the city of Newark. This was truly a collaborative effort, and we developed a very comprehensive plan along with many of our community partners, and we will get more into this in a few seconds. It encompasses 3 basic strategies. Homelessness is not an isolated issue. It's an issue across the country. We have to do everything in our power to end it. When we lift up those most in need, we lift up our entire community. So with us today to discuss our comprehensive plan is the city's homelessness czar, Louis Ulerio, Jim Policchio, chair of the City of Newark's Homeless Commission. And following that conversation about Newark's plan, we're expanding discussion and speaking with Ken Kraft from Southern California. He's the CEO of Hope the Valley Rescue Mission. His company's mission is to prevent, reduce, and eliminate poverty, hunger, and homelessness. In 2021, his company helped with the mission of the development of 6 tiny home villages in Los Angeles County, California. These 6 villages provided over 900 beds. This was in addition to the 506 beds that are already there. Hope of the Valley Rescue Mission helped to previously develop in Southern California.
All right. So, I mean, I'm excited for today's show. Definitely learn more about our comprehensive plan that was rolled out this week, right? Yesterday. So I want to go into Newark News. We're going to talk about that right before we bring on the first guest. So staying on the subject of housing. So one of my favorite programs that Newark has that your administration developed is the Newark Land Bank Section 8 Home Ownership Conversion Program. And on November 29th, you, along with Invest Newark, Youth Build Newark, and other dignitaries presented 4 families in Newark with the keys to their first home, which I thought was amazing. And I want to ask you, how did that feel to hand over those keys to those, you know, Newark residents and to help, you know,
change that was the amazing. Yeah. That's probably, like you said, is one of the best programs that, mm-hmm. you know, does a lot for me. Just seeing people who were in generational public housing right. get an opportunity to own their own home, backyard, mm-hmm. just watching them and hearing them. And mm-hmm. that last woman was really, 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 heartfelt, that situation.
Right.
So it's exciting. We want to do it more.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I'm excited to see this. And I think Newark is are we the only city that does it? Or is he one of the...
Yeah, we're the only city in New Jersey, definitely,
that does it. In New Jersey, yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think other people are picking it up and beginning to do that. HUD is trying to expand it across the country, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Newark is setting trends, as always. And another good thing that came out of this program was the Youth Build Newark... they rehab this program. So it's a program with 16 to 24-year-olds. They were on your conversations with, on your Friday conversation show recently, which I think that was dope. I mean, it's amazing what this program is doing. They're helping to, you know, employ young people in Newark and give them a skill that they can take on to build careers with.
Yeah, and they're building homes in their own neighborhoods.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's crazy. They mm-hmm. get to walk past those homes and see what they've done.
Mm-hmm. All right, and let's go over some of the holiday events. We're in the holiday spirit this week. So the city had their Christmas tree light, and we finally got a new tree. That was on December 13th.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah, and Newark also is held their menorah lighting on December 22nd.
Yes,
the Kwanzaa celebration is coming up to take place on the 27th of December, which is next week. That's exciting.
Yeah, those are all incredible holidays, and I'm glad we get a chance to celebrate them.
Yeah. All right, Mayor, so we can bring on the first guest. You ready?
Yep. All right. Yep. Let's bring on Mr. Louis Ulerio, City of Newark Homeless Czar, and Jim Policchio.
All right.
How's everybody doing? Glad to have you on our show. Welcome to Raz in 60 with Desiree and myself. We've been doing this for a minute. This is, where we at, episode 3?
Season 3 of season 3.
Okay.
So we've been doing it for about three years. COVID, we had to take a break.
That's right. We had to take a break during COVID. Mm-hmm. But we're just going to talk about the strategic plan today. Mm-hmm. So, just introduce yourselves, let the audience know who you are, and then we can get right into what the strategic plan is.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Thank you for having me. My name is Luis Valerio. I'm the homeless czar for the city of Newark and also director of the mayor's office of homeless services.
Yeah, good morning, Desiree. Thanks for having me. Mayor, good morning. Jim Policcio. I'm chairman of the Homeless Commission for the City of Newark.
All right, awesome.
It's good stuff.
Yeah. So let's take it from the beginning. How did the idea of this strategic plan come about?
Yeah, I mean, it really started, because of the pandemic, right? We learned that during that really challenging period that we can come together and, you know, it looked like we literally bend systems to serve people in need during some really difficult times. And it just showed the ability of our community to come together to really take on some really big challenges. And we wanted to continue that. And, you know, the mayor charged us to develop this plan to build off of that momentum, to build a plan that will take us right through the next few years to continue doing some of that work and making some deeper impact in our community with partners, right? Public and partner, public and private, county, state, and local, really coming together under this plan to really have some collective impact on how we were going to be able to do this. Yeah.
Right. So can you explain some of your community partners? And can you also just go into why you thought it was important to have a public private partnership with, you know, some organizations within Newark?
Yeah, like the mayor says, this issue is heavy, right? It's heavy stuff. This is not easy. It's very complex. So we knew that we had to reach out of city government, right, across systems, across sectors, to our peers at the county and a state level, to our public and private partners, and we could bring people together around a plan, right? A roadmap on how we're going to really be able to tackle something like this large and move it, right? Because we do need people to move this very heavy object. So we knew that we wanted to bring people together to develop these strategies. So I'm really proud to say that it was a very overwhelming response from our community. They wanted to be a part of this. It was over 100 community members, raised their hand to be a part of, whether it's a work group or an interview or you know, brainstorming. And that's important. But to me, what I'm most proud of is that we included the voice of the unhoused in our city. So we also went into our shelters. We conducted focus groups to hear from them, right? Their voice is really what made this plan. I thought that it was so important to just listen to them on how we can do better, right, and what we need to do to move this forward. So we did these focus groups, and we also did surveys across 3 drop-in centers. So it's a really quick survey. We had our partners do them, and it's really simple questions. You know, how, you know, what do you need now, and what do you need to get you moving, and what is something we can do to improve as a city, as a shelter, or, you know, as the Office of Homeless Services. So to me, that was really key in this and developing this, and I'm really proud of that as well.
If I could just add to that, I think, you know, Luis summed it up, you know, really nicely. And I have to say, from a private sector perspective, you know, I met the mayor, you know, many years ago. We discussed a number of topics that, you know, affect the city and our relationship with the city. And I think the strategic plan comes from, for me, was critical because, you know, you need a roadmap. And this, right, this defines a roadmap, and it really sets the stage for where we go. But the, you know, the mayor's sense for humanity and his belief that collaboration between government and the private sector and philanthropic foundations and boots on the ground social services, that vision, pulling that together, to me, from an operator's perspective, that became real for me, right? That I understood that that's how you solve problems. Making all that happen is not easy, right? Orchestrating all of that. And, you know, the mayor convinced me, he'll tell you about how we met originally, that convinced me that with the proper plan, and what Luis described is exactly it, that's boots on the ground work, right? This didn't just fall out of the sky. That's meaningful, and I really do think it sets a proper roadmap for us to be able to explain what we're doing. It has the input of the community, which is critical, and it's real. And I think it will evolve, and you'll see it to continue to evolve with input from people, because we're not perfect. We think we got a pretty good plan laid out here, but I can promise you we'll continue to improve it so that it looks like what the community requires as we continue to move forward. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah.
You
want to go ahead, man?
No, that's good stuff. Mm-hmm. And you also spoke to individuals that are actually homeless in order mm-hmm. to put this together. Mm-hmm. How was that experience?
I mean, it was heartbreaking, right? Because you hear their stories, right? Their journeys, where they're coming from, and these folks have aspirations as well. They have goals. They have dreams. And sometimes they feel like they're shut out of not just the economy, but also of the community. But that's not the case. Obviously, we were there to listen to them and how we can do better, kind of break down that barrier. Because, you know, if you stay in shelter for a very long time, unfortunately, you start developing this mindset that this is where you're going to be. Mm. It's not. And that's why we were there. We wanted to listen to them. And we really weren't surprised about the responses. I mean, it was a lot of the same themes, right? They wanted their private space. They wanted the culture in the shelters to improve, right? They wanted people to respect them and to speak to them, right, with respect. So that's something we need to do better with. And of course, housing and services. So a lot of it, we really weren't surprised, but we said to ourselves, okay, well, we really need to do it this time, right? Because if they're telling us this, we need to act on it. So now we have the responsibility to act on it. Mm-hmm. So that's why we're here, and that's why we really put this plan together and move it forward.
Yeah. That's powerful. I think it's very, it's a smart move to definitely get the perspective of people who are homeless. And like just going back to yesterday with Miss Pringle, like just listening to her speak, like she was funny, but then she made some good points, you know. And people who are homeless, some people feel like it's such a, you know, it's far from their current reality, but it could be a check away. It could be an unemployment, absolutely. You know, mm-hmm. being fired from your job, mm-hmm. and you can wind up in that same situation. So I think some people, I mean, the looking at it from the perspective of understanding that this could be any one of us is what's crucial.
Absolutely.
Right?
Well, I mean, you know, Miss Pringle yesterday was inspiring, and it's real. Like, we need to hear more of those voices. The strategic plan reflects that.
Yeah.
You know, you talk about experiences with, you know, who I've met since this process began for me. Mm. You know, I spent years walking past homeless people,
right?
And then I would maybe feel good about myself by offering someone something, you know, that will give them relief for 1 minute. Mm-hmm. You know, that's about me feeling good about me. That's not me making someone feel good. That's not solving a problem, you know. And you know, I would tell you, one morning standing at Penn Station at, you know, 5 a.m. on a cold day, looking at someone, thinking, when is somebody going to do something about this? And then thinking to myself, well, who's somebody?
Right.
Somebody's me. Somebody's not going to fall out of the sky. Mm-hmm. Someone's all of us. And you know, I mean, that's real. And we all have a role in this. It's strategic plan's great. We're in this room. It's fantastic. We got to get this message out to the people that, you know, we need to solve this. And we need to solve this in a real way, because these are real people, as Lewis and Ms. Pringle pointed out yesterday. So I think, you know, part of our role is to bring that message out. But don't just bring a message out. Bring a message out with a plan that allows us to execute and actually achieve something. And it's not about a handout, it's about a hand up, right? Right. And that's what we're trying to do here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what exactly are the three strategies? And you know, how are you going to use them?
Yeah. So, you know, we thought about just like the continuum, right? Like, how do we bring someone that's and again, you know, we decided to serve chronically homeless because we knew that was the most vulnerable population in our city and the folks that are more likely to be on the streets and in shelter too long. Right. So we knew that was the group we wanted to serve first through this plan, because if we improve the systems for them, then we can kind of uplift the entire system for everyone else. So the strategy one is just focused on street homeless. So these are folks that are literally on the streets. We just have to, there's a lot of good work happening right now. We just have to do better coordination. And we need to get more data in our hands, because data is going to drive our efforts, you know, because it's really complex, right? Street homelessness is very complex. But the more data we have, the better informed we have, and the better we know how to really address it. So it's going to be, you know, learning more about, you know, the folks that we're serving, better coordination, you know, some innovations on bringing some folks indoors. So that's strategy one, is really focusing on street homeless. Strategy two is improving our shelter system, because a lot of the folks that are outside is because they don't want to enter the shelter system for many reasons. So we want to partner with our shelters to improve their culture, right? Train them, right? Give them resources. One of the things we heard a lot from our focus groups is jobs. People want to work. They want that opportunity to work. So we want to integrate employment into the shelters as well. Behavioral health is really a big part of it. So we want to partner with substance abuse providers and mental health providers to bring that to the shelters, but also bring that into the community to serve the folks that are unsheltered as well. And finally, it's housing. Housing and prevention. Hope Village is just an incredible model. We want to do more Hope Village. And it's a model that's just been so impactful, Mayor, and we want to do more of it. But it's also supportive housing, right? And then thinking about creatively, how can we create or close the gap for folks that are experiencing homelessness? So are we looking at single room occupancies, which are single room, spaces? Or are we looking at master leasing, So thinking creatively out of the box and how we can really tackle housing, because it is a challenge as well. So combine those three strategies. Those are only some. There's 25 of them. I haven't memorized them all. But all of them will contribute to this plan here.
Sounds good.
You want to add to it, Jim?
I do. I think, everything that Lewis said is spot on. I go back to the strategies, and I'll go back to Ms. Pringle, right? Yeah, we got to create momentum by meeting individuals where they are, right? And I tell you, that was an eye-opener for me. Like, I come to a place, I go to a place, I leave a place, I think they're there, I'm here. No, we're all here, right? So, we got to meet people where they are, that's for sure. And we have to, the input that we're receiving kind of grounds us in what the real solutions are. Everything that Lewis touched on relative to, the housing and the jobs and all of that is going to be critical. But I'm the mayor's asked me to think bold, right? And I want to pick up that challenge. And I think we got to start thinking about where we go long term, like what this plan sets us up for. We have an opportunity, if we do this right, to rethink how we build the neighborhoods of the future, right? So, like, I want to be creative in looking at the housing market, looking how we finance housing. This isn't whether people should have a home. We all agree people should have a home. It's what's it cost to have a home.
Right.
And there's enough money out there, I believe, if properly engineered, so we can create an opportunity to create a home. Let's create one home. Then let's create two homes. Then let's create a neighborhood. Then let's create a butcher shop. Let's create a church. Let's create a fire station. Let's create a police department. This won't take 5 minutes, but it only takes 5 minutes to understand what's right and wrong.
Right.
And what's right and wrong is we got to rebuild the neighborhoods. And maybe I don't see it in my lifetime, but I can tell you what, we'll put the foundations in place to make sure that we can do that. And that's what we're setting out to do. We're going to need help. The help starts with people like Ms. Pringle saying, this is real. These are real people. We want to do this. So I think, we are on a good track. This is not time to spike the ball in the end zone. We're still in the locker room, right? But I can tell you that we've got a good game plan here, and we're going to work hard and be flexible to make sure we can deliver.
Right. It's ironic what you said, the earliest stages of human development, like people could basically go outside and grab some twigs and leaves and build something and be under whatever they shelter themselves, right? And be free from the elements that were, dangerous to them. I mean, the society advances and becomes more, have more resources, and that problem that didn't exist then becomes a problem now that we've organized people into society. Now you can't get a shelter over your head, right? You can't. And if you just put anything together, then that's a problem,
right?
So it's just interesting that the society advances itself, but the problem we didn't have when we were basically primitive becomes a problem for us when we become more sophisticated. Right, so I think it can be dealt with too.
Yeah, I think you make a great point, Mayor. And we may be more primitive than we think.
When it comes to
how we think about these problems.
Right.
We ought to be listening more, taking this, if you want to call it sophistication. We know how to do these things.
Right.
We just got to go about doing them. Sometimes, you know, I want to avoid with this doing the unimportant beautifully. I don't want to be talking about things that are wonderful. I'd rather do the things that really matter, that really impact people's lives. And it's not about me, right? It's about us. When I say, you know, doing the unimportant beautifully scares me, right? It's to the mayor's point. These are basic fundamentals of life, whether they're mine or yours or Ms. Pringle's or anybody else that's impacted by this problem. We all basically want the same things. You know, we have the ability to create that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's great.
I wanted to, can y'all talk more about, yesterday you mentioned the drop-in center that will eventually be built near Penn Station. Can you, can Lewis or Jim talk more about that?
Yeah, so we're in the process, and the Lieutenant Governor and the Mayor mentioned it yesterday at the press conference, the opportunity of building a drop-in center near the Penn Station area. You know, Penn Station is actually part of our plan, is we want to increase our focus and efforts in and around Penn Station. We've done some work already. We've seen some results, but we need to do more. And I think the Penn Station, the drop-in center, I'm sorry, will provide a center, right? A center that will attract these individuals and provide services to them. It's like a one-stop shop, to be honest with you. I mean, it's going to have employment. It's going to have health. It's going to have case management. It's going to have a food and education in this one center. And I think that's going to be the anchor for that area, because it's going to pull and I want to say this too, it's not just for individuals experiencing homelessness. It's really going to be for the community, because anybody can really go in there and receive any of those services as well. So right now we're in the early planning stages. We are waiting for the award. We're partnering with private partners as well to kind of fill the gap. But, you know, there's a lot of commitment, a lot of excitement about an opportunity of having, you know, something like that in the downtown area. And I think it'll be just incredible once it's built. Yeah.
You know, what excites me about that a little bit is, and I would, you know, I'm thinking about it. A lot of these concepts were just introduced to me over the last, you know, 6 to 12 months, or even, well, let's say 6 months. You know, we create an environment with the drop-in center where we provide, you know, an immediate ability to give direct services by qualified providers, right? So I'm not a healthcare provider. So we need those people who understand it, and they're out there and they're working every day. We have to give them the tools. So if we provide a center where we make those services available to people who need them, it's on the spot, right? It's not, I'm here, are you okay? Call me if you need anything. Right. We don't find people in the circumstances that I've observed who are in a position to call you when they need something. They need something when it's recognized and those services should be available. That's the momentum that I was referring to earlier. And I think the drop-in center is, you know, is the beginning of that. And I think the drop-in center turned into something very different if we do it right from the beginning, because it'll evolve. It's really exciting.
So some of the services will be like healthcare.
Sure.
Job placement, workforce development, and things like
counseling,
that.
Counseling
mental
where
health
required.
Services.
Provided by professionals who understand that, right? You know, we ask different elements of our social structure now to provide those services, and they're not qualified.
Right?
And I do think there's a connectivity between a center like that, the social system for providing, well, I'll call it the social court, right? The social courts that exist in the city today that provide guidance and protect the community. And of course, law enforcement and how law enforcement interacts and can interact differently. Now, I'm probably getting a little over my skis here, but I'm telling you, like, we got to touch all the bases, because everyone has a role in this. And from what I have seen, everyone's intentions are good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we need to create more entry points for individuals who are in need of services, because sometimes it's really difficult for them to navigate. Right. There's so many numbers, so many doors they got to knock on. But if we come up with really clear entry points where they can come and they have clear expectations of what services they're going to receive, it's just going to make things easier. You know, and the drop-in center could be just that. And, you know, an individual can come in and not really do anything. I mean, they may want to go and just get on the computer, right? And that's fine with us, but it's an opportunity to say, hey, hello, shake their hand and say, hey, I'm Lewis, I'm here, just in case you need me, right? And it may take maybe 10 times for that person to say, hey, Lewis, I do need something, right? But it's part of engagement. It's a part of having that open door. And, you know, we want to, you know, create that there in that area, but also open up some doors throughout the community as well. They can probably serve as that. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure, you go ahead.
No, I just want to say, because I think this is very important when we begin to talk about the drop-in center, because we're creating this. And I do think that compassion, that's a center for compassion. at every level, right? On the services side, and all of the things that keep our society in balance need to be there. So when I talk about, I don't like the word courts because it suggests someone is being taken somewhere, right? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an evaluation of where we are so that we can help create an environment where we put people in a position where they can grow out of this. Because I don't think you pull people out of this, right? And I'm not an expert. I think you gotta give them the fertile ground to grow out of this, right? Go back to the primitive references that the mayor made earlier. Everybody basically wants the same thing. We don't know, if not for the grace of God, why I'm not there, why I have my health, or I didn't lose a job. I mean, that could happen to anyone. We just gotta create the fertile ground for them to grow. And I think that center provides, could potentially, if we do it right, provide the opportunity to do that.
Absolutely.
That's an excellent analogy.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. It definitely is. Yeah. So any last things you guys want to say about the plan, period, that you think folks should know?
It's comprehensive, led by the community, and it's going to be driven by data. I mean, those are three important, really foundations that this plan stands on. And it's really, like I said during the press conference, it's a call to action. I mean, we're asking people be a part of this, right? This is our community. This is a rare moment that we can come together. There's a lot of energy around this, and people are excited about this opportunity. And it's very unique, right? This is something that could potentially be a model, national model, right? You have private and public, all levels of city government coming around this issue. We're expecting greatness. I mean, we're expecting some really great outcomes. So we're really excited about that. So join us if you want to be a part of this. We're here.
Okay. So, and I think, I mean, like you said, it can be the possibility of it becoming a model for at least for the state and maybe even the country. I mean, NORC continues to set the bar, in so many ways with public safety, with this, mm-hmm. with homelessness. I think it's amazing. And how can people, if people want to be involved and want to help or want to just give some, some ideas, mm-hmm. how can they do that?
So to end homelessness at ci.norc.nj.us.
All right. Yep.
Send me a message. We'll take it from there.
Jim, you have anything to say?
I just want to thank you for giving us the platform to talk to people. And as Lewis said, I want to encourage people to be involved and be engaged. If you're looking for perfection, you picked the wrong guy. I just want you to know that we are a work in progress, but the people that I've met around this has really been amazing to me. Mayor, thank you for providing me the opportunity and opening my eyes to how we may be able to contribute in some small way. So, I would just encourage people to stay involved and speak up. We're not offended. We want to know. We need to get this right, and there's no one center of the universe that has all the knowledge. So voices are important. Thank you very much for having us.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you for getting on.
Yeah.
Our next guest is Ken Kraft, CEO of Hope of the Valley Rescue Mission. Ken has joined us virtually from Southern California. His company has assisted in the mission of decreasing the homeless population in LA County, California. Ken will explain his partnership with LA County and the guests and the great work he's doing in Southern California. We're glad to have you on with us this morning.
Ken, I was reading about some of the great work you're doing. I mean, I read about the tiny home villages you've helped to construct in California. I read about just your passion for the work of just helping to eliminate homelessness in Southern California. And I was really impressed. It seems like you are just truly dedicated and passionate about this work. And I was, amazed by some of the articles I read. I read that you also was homeless for 3 days, because you wanted to experience what it was like, and you definitely were impacted by that. You talked about the physical impact, the emotional, and even the mental impact it had on you. So before we start with our conversation, can you just talk a little bit about that experience when you chose to live your life homeless for 3 days just to get that experience?
Yeah, it was quite an experience, and it was actually 100 hours. And it was a year ago. It was December 13th. A Pacific storm was coming in, and it was going to be 38 degrees. And I was dropped off at an undisclosed location along with our CFO, and we immediately ran to get some cover under a freeway overpass, slept in dirt, couldn't sleep. It was miserable. At about 4:30 a.m. that particular night, I was ready to tap out and say, I can't do this anymore. But instead, we ran to a donut shop. I only had $5 to last me an entire week. And I spent half of that $5, $2.50, on the best cup of coffee I've ever had in my life. And then I had to go to the bathroom, and there's no bathroom, so I had to run to a Taco Bell. I had to charge my phone, but they didn't have any plugs, so I had to run to a Starbucks, only to find out that they didn't have any more plugs because they don't want homeless charging their phones. And so it was just this constant learning experience. I got kicked out of a shopping center for no other reason than the fact that I looked homeless, I had a backpack, but my takeaway from all of that being on the streets was that it's nearly impossible to stay sober, sane, and safe living on the streets. And we must do anything and everything we can to bring people indoors so that they can move out of survival mode into possibility mode.
Wow, that's amazing. All right.
Yeah, that is an incredible story.
Mm-hmm. And it definitely, talks about how difficult it is to just live normally or just an enjoyable life on the street, you know?
And 38 degrees is pretty cold in Southern California, but over here it might be a little warm. So how did that get you to begin thinking about the tiny homes?
Well, it was interesting because as I was on the streets, when I mentioned I went to the Starbucks, there was one homeless gentleman who was sitting in a corner, and I walked up to him and I said, so how did you make it through last night? Where'd you sleep? And he told me where he slept. And I said, look, man, I'm newly homeless. I said, what advice would you give me? And he looked at me. He had no idea who I was. And he said, man, you need to go to Hope of the Valley. Wow. He didn't know I was the CEO of Hope of the Valley. And I said, really? I said, do you think they'd help somebody like me? And he goes, oh yeah, they help everybody. And I said, well, if they help everybody, then why are you out on the streets? And he says, I was in with Hope of the Valley. He goes, they got me a job. I was in the shelter. I saved enough money. I moved out. And then the pandemic hit. I lost my job and I'm back on the streets, but I've been calling him every day, but they're at capacity. And man, it just broke my heart. I walked away and I made a phone call. I called our nearest shelter and I said, listen, you need to get a van here immediately, pick this guy up. I walked back to him and I said, his name was Christian. I said, hey, Christian. I said, look, I haven't been totally honest with you. I am homeless, but only part-time, for this entire week. And I told him who I was, and he just had this shock look, and the van came, he started crying, I was crying, and made sure that we got him to a place of safety. But one of the things that I've realized, living in a very, wow, in Los Angeles that has nearly 70,000 homeless people on any given night, is that we have to bring people indoors. And historically, it was very difficult to bring people indoors because of existing policy. But policy changed. And that changed in 2018 when Mayor Eric Garcetti declared a shelter emergency, which made tiny homes an allowable use for emergency housing. And so there's all kinds of different iterations of these tiny homes, but the ones that we used were called Pallet Shelter out of Seattle, Washington. They're 64 square feet and they can be erected in 1 hour's time. And inside there's two beds, there's air conditioning, heating, electrical plugs, windows, and most importantly, a front door that locks. And we have found that, once we educated, those that were living on the streets about this possibility, that we had no trouble filling it. And we are at capacity every night. We currently have 6 tiny home communities, 460 units, and well over 900 beds. And it works. We see the fruit of it because when people come in, they're no longer worried about what am I going to eat? Right. Where am I going to go to the bathroom? How do I protect myself? Now they can move forward and we can start working with them to address mental health issues, substance use issues, job training, and job placement.
What's the name of the place that you said out of Seattle?
It's called Pallet Shelter. Pallet Shelter. Yeah, great organization.
And how much does that cost you guys?
You know, the units themselves are only $10,000. But of course, you know, if you're going to build a community, then of course the fire department, you know, building and safety, land use gets involved. And the cheapest we were able to build was one of the one of the sites that had 114 units. We were able to get the price down all in $42,000 per unit. And that includes, of course, all the electrical, sewer, bathrooms, fencing, offices, et cetera.
Yeah, we're embarking on the same stuff here in the city of Newark. We're definitely not paying $42,000 for it. I think we have to figure that out. I think the cheapest we've gotten to is about $100,000.
Yeah, it's an economies of scale also, because it was a pretty large community, and we've just learned ways that, you know, you don't have to pour concrete pads. We can anchor them to the asphalt, and there's things that we've been able to do to kind of save money.
Right. Sounds good. So what has been the response from the homeless community since these tiny villages have been introduced? How, I guess, like, what are the responses? Is it positive? Is it negative? Do people enjoy the opportunity or the option to have a tiny home to stay in?
You know, the stories abound of people who have been able to come in, and they take great pride. Matter of fact, I was at one of the sites two nights ago, and I was walking around taking pictures because of the numbers of people that actually decorated their tiny homes with Christmas lights and with the decorations on the outside. And they have little plants on the outside and a welcome home mat. And then you look inside and they've actually taken great pride in creating a home, even though it is interim. Okay. It is transitional. It is not permanent housing. But you know, one of the things that we say a lot at Hope of the Valley, because we do believe in permanent and supportive and affordable housing, but we know that the streets cannot be the waiting room for permanent housing any more than if I had hypothermia, you wouldn't say to me, Ken, wait in the snow until the doctor can see you. No, we must bring people indoors and stabilize them and begin to address those underlying issues while we're creating the affordable housing. There's a lot of affordable housing and supportive housing projects going on, but typically those take 2 to 3 years to build. In the meantime, we need to bring people indoors, and the tiny homes allow that to be a viable solution.
Right.
So what is the time frame that people have when staying in this tiny home, you know, until they are able to find the permanent housing? What is how long is their stay normally? Is it a couple weeks, months?
Yeah. Well, you know, in a perfect world, interim housing, such as the tiny homes, should be a 3 to 6 month process. But the problem is you have to have throughput. You have to have somewhere for them to go, you know, out of the interim housing. And one of the challenges that we have in Los Angeles is there just is not enough affordable and permanent and supportive housing. A lot of it's being constructed right now, but it's not in place. So unfortunately, we do have people that have been living in these tiny homes for well over a year now. They have housing vouchers. You know, we're working with them. Our housing navigators are working with them to move them into permanent housing. But actually finding that permanent housing is taking longer than we'd like. But it's just the reality of not having enough of it.
Do you find that folks prefer the tiny home option as opposed to a shelter because of the fact that it's a little more personal, they have a little more privacy, they can kind of like make it feel more like a house or a home for them?
Yeah, that's a great question, because we've been kind of measuring it, because yes, we do have you know, these 6 tiny home communities with over 900 beds, but we also have 3 very large congregant shelters where each one kind of has their own private cubicle and their own private space, but they don't have doors on them. And so we've kind of been measuring, you know, what is the response? And it's interesting because you have a lot of folks that do prefer the tiny homes, but you have a number that actually prefer the congregant sites with their own cubicle. And one of the reasons why is just because it's all temperature controlled. With the tiny homes, you have your tiny home that's temperature controlled, but if you have to go to the bathroom, you have to walk to an outdoor to a, you know, a shower unit or a bathroom unit, and it can still be pretty cold at night. And but yet the indoor sites, it's all under one roof, temperature controlled. And I do find that the congregant sites, people get to know each other better. There's more integration with residents, building that community faster. Sometimes in the tiny home communities, the fact that they have their own private place and they can lock the door and be by themselves, it creates a bit more isolation. So there's definitely pros and cons to both of them. And you know, one of the things that we say at Hope of the Valley, it's not either or, it's yes and. It's all of the above. Whatever we can do, whatever we can create, so that we have a safe space where people can come in, whether it's a tiny home, whether it's a congregant site, whether it's shared housing site, safe parking, whatever it is, we've got to create that space.
Right. I mean, I think pretty much answered most of my questions. Sounds good. The work is amazing.
It's amazing work. We'd love to hear more about that. We need to connect you with our guy over here, Louis Lario. We just got finished talking to them. You know, see if we could, you know, get some support on the work that we're doing here. It's great work, and I understand the new mayor in L.A. has taken this on head first. So, you know, God bless the efforts that you guys are doing out there.
There was one more thing I want to ask Ken about the partnership you have, or the you're working closely with the county of LA to help. They are the ones who are helping to fund this, right? The county of Los Angeles. Can you talk about that partnership?
Yeah, it's actually the city of Los Angeles.
City of Los Angeles. Okay.
So, you know, we worked very closely with the city of Los Angeles in the design, the layout, but yes, they did fund it. So they're the ones that put up the money. And it's interesting that the locations that these tiny home communities are built on is all government owned land. And that's right. What helps expedite the process, right, and helps keep the price down. So we're not like purchasing this land. Like the very first site that we opened on Chandler Boulevard was rec and park site. So the city recreation and park site. The second one was a recreation and park site. The third one was a city owned parking lot. The fourth one was a Metro parking lot, which is our bus system. And then the next one was a Caltrans along the side of the freeway land. And then the last one was a rec and park site. So you see government entities all working together and saying, what spare land do we have that is not being utilized that could be used now under an emergency and under a crisis to bring people in? So we work very closely with the city on these tiny home projects. And also we're working very closely with the state of California, as we recently have been able to purchase 4 hotels. And we are now in the process of converting those hotels into 181 units and 724 beds that will be used predominantly for moms and kids that are experiencing homelessness in Los Angeles.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
Good work, man. Doing God's work. Thank you for sharing with us today. We appreciate you being on our show and sharing over here in New Jersey the kind of work. We obviously got our work cut out for us, but not as big as you guys. And you're doing a great and awesome job over there.
And thanks for being here at 7 a.m. your time.
Right.
Thank you.
God bless you. Take care.
All right. Thank you. God bless you. Bye-bye.
I just want to first thank our guests, Louis Lario, Jim Policcio, Ken Kraft, for coming on and sharing their experiences and the work that they're doing on both coasts, here in the East and the West. Stay tuned for more developments from the city of Newark around eliminating homelessness and how you can get involved. And I'm going to thank everybody for listening, of course. And make sure you share this episode link and all other episodes of Rising 60 with your social circle. And remember, extreme poverty anywhere is a threat to human security everywhere. Kofi Annan, 7th Secretary General of the United Nations. God bless y'all. Happy holidays.